The following podcast may contain graphic content and details that some listeners may find disturbing. Listener discretion is advised. Hey everyone, welcome to this episode of Digital Forensics in Real Life by Magnet Forensics. I'm Kim Bradley. Boy, do we have an interesting case for you today. Today we'll be speaking with Larry McLean about the case of Pam Hupp, a case out of St. Louis, Missouri that involves at least two murders, three court trials, and as many twists and turns as a Hollywood movie. Literally. The Hollywood movie about this case is in production as I record this, with Renee Zellweger playing the lead. But the real star of this case is Digital Forensics, as the data that Detective McLean was able to pull from Pam's cell phone was essential in recovering the truth and bringing the killer to justice. Our guest Larry McLean served as a scout and sniper in the United States Marine Corps before transitioning to a 23-year career in law enforcement, spending most of that time in investigations but specializing in digital forensics. He served with the O'Fallon, Missouri Police Department in the St. Louis metro area as a detective and also managed a digital forensics laboratory for the region. He served on several task forces, including the FBI Crimes Against Children Task Force, the Secret Service Electronic Crimes Task Force, and the Missouri Internet Crimes Against Children Task Force. There's so much interesting about this case, and I can't stop thinking about it since my conversation with Larry. But my big takeaway from the digital perspective here is the way that Larry describes Pam's cell phone. He calls it the third witness to the tragic events of August 16, 2016, one that doesn't have a bias or perspective and only reports the truth. With that, let's get on with the case. Thanks for joining me, Larry.
Thanks, Kim. Nice to see you.
Great chatting with you. So we're going to talk about the case of Pam Hupp. Tell me how you became involved with this case.
Wow. Yeah, I don't know if you get this a lot, but wow. Which case, Kim? Because this case involves three deaths and a lot of people, and it's compartmentalized. So there was an original case where Betsy Faria was murdered and a man was convicted and sent to prison and it was overturned. I was originally involved with that case because they sent a bunch of computers to my lab from the suspect in that case. And they asked me to look for evidence of anything related to insurance, was the original request, which I did and found nothing. That was the original case. So I knew about the original case, the death of Betsy Faria. And then one day I'm sitting in the lab on my machine using my tools, working on a case. I couldn't tell you what case, but we did a lot of child exploitation cases. It might have been one of those. And the phone rings. Not unusual. I pick it up and it's, I'm on a multi-jurisdictional task force. I'm a task force officer with the FBI and we have a regional lab, conjoined with other agencies. So I'm not at my physical agency that is my parent agency. So I'm sitting at my desk and the phone rings and it's Mike, my big boss at O'Fallon, right? Many bosses depending on which hat I put when I pick up the phone. So I pick it up and I said, "Hey, how you doing?" And he goes, "Okay." He goes, "Hey, we're working a home invasion where we have a home invasion, guy comes in with a knife and the victim grabs a gun and shoots the suspect and kills him. Will you have my attention?" I don't get that call every day. O'Fallon's a bedroom community, a suburb of St. Louis. It's a fairly safe community. We're not having bodies all day long every day. So he has my attention. I said, as I always do when we have these full push kind of cases, or you know it's going to be something elevated, "I'm on my way." Literally, the sheriff's office is 10 minutes from the police department. So I'm going to jump in. My gear's already loaded in my vehicle. I'm going to jump in. And he says, "Hey, there's a twist." And I go, "There's a twist?" He said, "Yeah, the victim is Pam Hupp." To which I then say, I'm on my way. Because I certainly knew who Pam Hupp was, because there was, you know, it was world famous in St. Louis, right? That's the joke. But this had a lot of media attention. Dateline NBC had already done multiple episodes about this initial homicide of a woman named Betsy Faria, where her husband was convicted, later overturned. And it was overturned based on the fact that the initial judge erred, this is very high level, that the defense wasn't allowed to introduce information about Pam Hupp. Pam Hupp was allegedly Betsy's best friend, kind of a late to the party best friend, if you will, who 2 days before the murder, Betsy Faria, the original victim, gets a insurance, signs her insurance policy over to this Pam Hupp. Pam Hupp's the last one to see her alive. You know, so the whole community right from the get-go was like, hold on. We don't think this guy did it. We think she did it, and we think the police department erred, and it was a rush to judgment. So, long story short, they did have a – it was overturned. They had a second bench trial, and he was acquitted, the husband of Betsy Faria, based on the evidence that a lot of people thought that Pam Hupp was guilty of that. That has to set the stage. That's the initial. This thing comes in stages. So there's the killing of Betsy Faria, which I had a tangential touch on because I did look at computers related to the suspect, who would have been her husband, Russ. A lot of their Dateline NBC, the TV show, that does a lot of true crime stuff, had done several episodes. This they were involved heavily in this. It was all in the paper. You know, people were real concerned that it was a miscarriage of justice. This guy's acquitted. It's a big deal. And now, this controversial figure at the center of this, who people think is really the suspect in this murder, who was never charged and never found guilty, not only not charged, but wasn't even investigated during the initial homicide investigation, is suddenly a victim of a home invasion. Okay. So, again, Mike just says there's a twist. It's Pam Hupp. And I jump in the truck and I head over to the police department. And you've been involved in these, Kim. You know how these are. These are full push, the war room. Everybody's involved. But certainly we are treating Pam Hupp as the victim. Play it straight and nobody's making any judgments. And I'm just looking at it. And the story comes out initially that Pam has... was out running errands, I believe. She pulls in her driveway. As she pulls in her driveway, a car comes screaming up behind her. Guy jumps out of the passenger seat, not the driver, jumps in her passenger seat, holds a knife to her throat, and starts saying something about, you know, you're going to take me to get Russ's money. So there's a piece that's missing here. In addition to the reasons that people think that Pam was involved. Pam had, just days before the murder, Betsy had signed over a $150,000 life insurance policy to Pam Hupp. And Pam Hupp at one time during the investigation said, oh, she wanted me to put it in trust and hold on to it for her daughters. Her daughters never got the money. They sued for the money. The judge basically is like, well, it's a shame I can't give you the money and I should. But legally, she gets the money because Betsy signed it over. Then later she said, no, Betsy really wanted me to have the money all the time because she thought her daughters would be irresponsible and blow the money and whatever. So it's controversy over the insurance money, which, you know, leads to maybe that was a motive. So when she's saying this statement, she's tying in the original murder, the Betsy Faria murder. She's saying this unknown guy jumps in my car, sticks a knife to my throat, says, you're going to go take me to get Russ's money. Okay, so we all know what she's talking about. This is no confusion about this. He even has a note in his pocket later when we find the body that is like what to do, you know, get Russ's money, hide body, you know, it's steps of things to do. So that occurs. So what she says is, you know, the guy's got the knife to her throat. She bats the knife away. The knife is later retrieved from the car, but it's sitting between the seat and the console like it's stored there. It's not flung. It's not on the ground. Another piece of the story. There's a lot of pieces of the story. You interrupt me anytime, Kim, because this story has a lot of tangents. So she runs. She runs in the house. She's got her cell phone in hand. Ding, ding, ding. She's got her cell phone in hand. Now, Larry, digital evidence, right? So I'm looking for digital footprints. She's got her cell phone in hand. She runs in. She gets makes it to the back bedroom. He's chasing her with the knife. She has a gun on her nightstand, a little, I think it was a Ruger 38, because she needed it for, you know, self-defense protection. She grabs the gun. She dials 911. And she says, hey, there's a guy with a knife. And I'm, you know, I have the recording, but you can listen to it on the TV show or whatever that, you know, she's screaming into the phone, you know, he has a knife and he's in the phone. Bam, bam, bam. And you hear on the 911 recording her murder this guy. Man, there's a catch. Most people don't know this. I don't know that we should tell most people this. But 911 actually starts recording about, what, 20, 30 seconds before the actual pickup. So usually if somebody's got a knife and they're chasing you through the house to murder you, that first 30 seconds, you'd probably think you would be screaming, commotion, panic. It's dead silence.
Wow.
Hello, 911. Stop. No, there's a person. And, you know, when we first listened to it, you know, you never want to make a conclusion about a case, because once you make the conclusion, you know how it is. The only evidence you see is the evidence that supports your conclusion. You have to play it straight. You have to follow the evidence, especially when it comes to digital evidence, the ones and zeros. I don't care about anything else. I want to follow the ones and zeros. I need context of the whole to make sense of what I'm seeing. I get that. So I'm playing it straight. But we all listen to this 911 call and we go, it sounds like a bad stage play. It sounds like bad acting. I mean, we're all thinking it. The commander, he says it, something ain't right. But we don't know that. So we're all sitting in the war room. I don't even go to the scene. And I'm sitting there and they finally roll the fingerprints. Because, you know, this guy dropped out of the sky with a knife and has tried to kidnap Pam Hutt. We don't know anything else. So it takes a while. The crime scene people get the fingerprints. They roll the prints. They get it through APHIS. You know, sorry, throwing out terms already, right? Acronyms. But they get the fingerprints back. And it turns out the guy's name is Louis Gumpenberger. Well, Gumpenberger is not Smith. And I go, I know that name. I know that name. And I start using a very high-speed investigative, cybercrime investigative tool that we all use called Google. So I start Googling Louis Gumpenberger, and I know this name. So long story short, I'm on the FBI task force, as I mentioned. And years ago, when I was on the task force, I got this one-off call. It's like, hey, Larry, you're out there in O'Fallon. Yeah, I'm out in O'Fallon. Hey, could you go take some photos of a car? And I'm like, yeah. What they said was they had, now see this thing spin. See how convoluted this is? 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon here. So they have, they come through and they say, can you go take photographs of a car on a civil suit in accident? Yeah. So the story is there's a guy who's driving intoxicated, crosses the center line, hits a vehicle. That vehicle spins out, hits another vehicle, which spins out and hits the third vehicle and barely dents it. But the third vehicle is being an FBI car, being driven by an FBI agent. So people hear FBI and lawsuit. Right? FBI is involved. Money. Cha-ching, right? So I went and out take a photo. But I remember when I'm looking at this original, just go take photographs from an accident, the guy driving that car who was intoxicated and crossed the center line was Louis Gumpenberger. And the name stuck in my head because it was so unusual. And Louis, unfortunately, in that accident, had a traumatic brain injury. And he was mentally incapacitated. And I remember that from, hey, yeah, the accident and the driver. He literally did not have the mental and really even the physical capability to plan or execute a crime like this. And I knew it immediately because I went and I Googled and I found that civil lawsuit involving the FBI online. And I'm like, I know who this is and something's not right. This guy's not capable of plotting, planning, and executing this crime. Okay, now our radar's up. Still playing it straight. Still looking at it as the way it should be, but our antennas are going up. So they bring the victim, Pam Hupp, remember, she's a victim at this stage, to the station to interview her. I'm there. I don't do the initial interview. They're walking her through that. And then I say, let me get in there. Let me talk to her. I want that phone. Because we know that piece of digital evidence is involved. And she's a victim, and it will corroborate her story. Great. So I get in there and I sit down with Pam and I, you know, explain the process and I get a written consent to search. She's the victim. We'd like to look at your phone. Oh, she's so helpful and chatty and talking and really kind of, you know, like we're out having lunch. Not someone who almost just got murdered, but, you know, you got to be careful. We know I've done a lot of homicides, a lot of violent crimes, and Kim, you have too. And you know that everybody does react differently. You have to have a baseline. So a lot of times I'm always disturbed by true crime stories or independent witnesses who aren't trained, who go, well, they didn't act right. People act very differently and under trauma. So you can't hang your hat on that. Okay. I thought it was a little odd, but, you know, just tick mark. People react differently. So I get the phone. She gives consent, and I run out the back door. Well, I didn't run, but I go out the back door. I jump in my truck. I run back to my lab, and I extract that device. And then I also used, I extracted the device, first of all, got a good extraction of it, ran some separate tools. I can mention IEF. That kind of dates the case a little bit. It was 2016. So I run IEF against it to look for all those robust artifacts, and I start realizing well, I wanted to look at the digital evidence. I wanted to retrieve the 911 call. I wanted to see the logs of the 911 call and to see was there any other activity on that phone other than that. And then I thought, well, you know, what's going on with geolocation information? It's a Samsung. I had enough training to understand Google location information, Google location services, and what that might do for the case. So as I'm looking at the extraction of phone, I'm looking at the artifacts. You can hear the big pause, right? As I'm looking at it, in my mind, first of all, is this guy drops out of the sky, unbeknownst. She has no idea who this is. We had no idea until the fingerprints come back. Where did this come from? How did these two stars collide? And I'm looking at the phone, and I can see her Google Maps, her Google location. And, you know, if you ever look at your own maps, if you go into Google and you're in your Google hemisphere and you open up maps and it's in your account and you click down on location services timeline, you see those big blue lines that go everywhere that show your daily travels. Well, I didn't know at that time. I do now and teach this in our AX320 cloud class that you can click on settings and look at more of the raw data to see what points they're using. Doesn't give you everything. Search warrant gives you more, but I didn't know it at the time. All I see is these big blue lines, but the big blue lines show me enough to show she was driving all over that area that day, and one of those blue lines go right past Lewis Gumpenberger's apartment. We found that he lives alone with his mother. He's developmentally disabled. He goes to work, I don't know if every day or most days, in a place that provides jobs to people with developmental disabilities where they like pack things in boxes on an assembly line kind of thing. Great program. They do a lot for those folks. But other than that, when Lewis is not at work, he essentially sits in a plastic chair in front of his apartment door and smokes cigarettes, listens to music, sits out there all day. So I have a blue line that goes right past my victim's house. But he lives off a service road to the major interstate. Interstate 70 runs through the town. And that's not quite enough, right? But it's enough for me to go, wait a minute, was she on the interstate or was she on the service road? Because if she's on the service road, maybe those two stars did collide. Okay, great. So now, exigent circumstance, search warrant. I have to tell you, I did 7 search warrants on this case. Every one of them had a non-disclosure order that I had to write as well. Now, this was a search warrant based off the phone and the Gmail account that was associated for a lot of information, but certainly one piece of that information is the Google location information. Now, this is 2016. I know that a lot of people are using that information and using those search warrants, but at that time, I could only find one person in Tennessee who had kind of done that. No one had done it in the Eastern District of Missouri that I was aware of. And so I was, you know, it wasn't like I was using a pony or a template, not that you should always use those, but I was having to build this as I was going on the fly. And, you know, on these full push cases, ain't nobody sleeping, ain't nobody going home. It is work. And, you know, there I am putting it together, getting the non-disclosure orders, racing back and forth to the courthouse, because at that time we weren't doing it electronically. But luckily not too far away. So I get that exigent circumstances order placed in, and then I think it was only like 4 hours. Google was back to me, which I don't know where we're at right now, but that was pretty impressive at the time. That's my memory. So I get it back, and part of the Google location services that they provide is a spreadsheet that not only shows the account, but it shows the data source, whether they're using GPS, they're using cell tower data, they're using Wi-Fi data to try to estimate that approximate location and activity. And then it actually shows their estimated meters from that location, Wi-Fi, whatever it is. And as I go through it, I'm going down, looking at the information, and I see, holy moly, it places her via Wi-Fi within 5 meters of where Lewis Gumpenberger lived for about 5 minutes, paused. She's there, not moving, stopped, and there. Okay, well, Google Location Services, I think still, I would argue, is the secret sauce of Google. It's not like they're telling investigators how to use this and what it means, right? So I'm trying to figure all this out. All I know is when I take all of the Google location information, now I would use World Map View with an Axiom, but at that time, the way I did it was I just took this spreadsheet and I made a KLM and I dumped it into Google Earth. And you know how Google Earth, and this is before I really figured out that she was at Gumpenberger. So I kind of ahead of myself. You know how Google Earth has that wonderful capability where whoop, that globe spins up and you see the globe and all of a sudden it drops the pins and it drops the pin. And one of the red pins is on his doorstep. And I'm like, what? Huh? And I'm like, no. So then I'm like, look at the, okay, spreadsheet, conversions on time, UTC, we're at -5, we're at -6, but wait a minute, it's Tuesday. So, you know, I'm kidding. You know how we are. I'm double checking my math. I'm double checking the lat longs. I'm double checking everything. Did I, because I'm always assumed I'm screwing something up. That can't be. I did it. Redid it. Boom. Redid. Did it. Boom. Redid it. Did it. Boom. And then I sat back, and this was late at night during the investigation. I don't even remember what night, but you got to put yourself into our computer crime lab. Great workstations. We each have our own little workstations, segmented off areas, cubes. And we love to work off the underlighting, you know, so it's just the underlighting at the desk. The lights are off. It's all dark in there except for the underlighting. I have robust resources that come to me from lots of grants, the FBI, NCFI, Secret Service, you know, all kinds of great equipment, and got screens everywhere. And here sits Google Earth with a pin on my, well, now I'm going to call him a victim, on Lewis Gumpenberger's doorstep. And I just sat there for a minute. I'll never forget this. I sat there like, wow. And I realized, I know. I'm the only one who knows. But right now I know that this wasn't happenstance. This guy just didn't pull up and fall, jump in her car. He didn't just fall out of the sky. Something ain't right. And I know what's going on. Now there's a lot more investigation, but it was a moment. You don't always have these in your career that you know you're standing on the threshold, but I knew. And that was a neat experience. And the next experience that was funny is I take a screenshot of that red pin, and I call my lieutenant, Mike, and I say, Mike, I'm sending you a screenshot. And I hear all this noise in the background. He's like, okay, well, we were just having a briefing. You know, they left me out because I'm the cyber guy, right? I'm doing my thing. But they're all in Mike's office. They got a big whiteboard and they're storyboarding and looking at everything. And everybody just happened to be there when I call. And I said, all right, let me know when you got it. Emailing it to you right now. And I'll never forget this. The email opens, I guess, and the whole room erupted into cheers. I got to be the knight in shining armor. And then Mike immediately said, it's about time you did something. So, like, really, Mike? Come on, buddy. You know, the funny joke is, in cyber, I was constantly going to training. I was, you know, hey, Larry, what's going on? Great, I'm in Alabama. Great, I'm in Florida. Great, I mean, you know, they're like, do you guys actually do any work? You're always in training. Now, you know, we work very hard. We're working a lot of cases. But as digital investigators, there's a heavy lift. There's a lot of training. And luckily, some of that training was about mobile devices, Google location services, cloud data, all of that. So, you know, his joke was about time you did something, but the whole place erupted. And then I continued to work that digital data, expanding the scope of the search warrant. We were able to use your Google location data to show her not only driving around, but she kept going to Dollar General. And one investigator did a great job by going to Dollar General, getting receipts of what she bought, and was able to match that knife that was found in the car, other things. And then evidence just started falling into place. When Mr. Gumpenberger was found, he had $900 in his pocket of crisp $100 bills. And there was another $100 bill that they found kind of back on her dresser. It was sequential in numbers to the other nine, which is, according to Secret Service, astronomically impossible. So stuff like that. Then, you know, this hits the news when we finally arrested her, and I'll get to that in a minute, when we arrested her, and this lady calls up and says, "Hey, I know who that lady is. I was standing out in front of my mobile home, and this lady pulls up and said she was a producer from Dateline NBC. Her name was Kathy. And Kathy said, hey, I'm trying to film a 911 call. We want to do a reenactment of a 911 call, and we need somebody to do it. And I will pay you $1,000 cash if you'll come with me to film this." And she's like, "Oh, I could use $900. You're a producer at Dateline NBC, just driving around looking for a good casting call, I guess." She jumps in. She actually went in the house. She had to put her dogs in and grabbed a knife and put it up her sleeve. I don't know that ever hits any of the news, but I talked to her, Miss Alford. And she put the knife up her sleeve because she was still sketchy, but she really wanted that money. She jumps in the passenger seat. They start to leave the mobile home community, and she's really getting weirded out. She's like, "Oh, I forgot something. Can you take me back?" And she gets back, and she jumps out like, "Get out of here, lady. I don't want nothing to do with you." You know, whatever she said. But she lived in a poor socioeconomic area, and it was a mobile home. But she had cameras. Surveillance cameras. And sure enough, she had her on tape. So there's Pam Hupp in her vehicle. We had her on tape. We brought her in. She does a photo lineup. She picks her out. The incident commander in the other room monitoring all this, and she looks through the photos. She makes a big production of the thing. She like looks at each one very carefully and turns them over. And then sorts them together again. The detective hands them to her and goes through each one individually at a time. But she went through the first time and didn't pick her out. We're like, maybe we're on the wrong track here. She does it a second time, and then she puts them down, looks up at the detective, hands the photo of Pam Hupp and goes, "That's her." Like, she just made like a big production out of it. But we're like, wow. So now we have, more and more and more evidence. So there was other evidence from a digital nature. So we have the phone, we have the cloud information, which broke the case. And then through a lot of effort, big team effort, a lot of detectives found, you know, like the guy goes to Dollar General and the crime scene who figures out this $100 bill is sequential. She caught that. She actually looked and caught that it was sequential. And there was like a piece of carpet under the body that looked like a carpet scrap. You know, it goes on and on and on. But in addition to that, you know, like I said, seven or nine, non-disclosure orders, cell phone extraction. She had a brand new GMC Acadia, and we took it to a dealership with a master mechanic and removed the OnStar and removed the infotainment center from the vehicle and shipped it to Quantico. It was so new, a brand new vehicle that year, that it hadn't been reverse engineered by, you know, like Burla or any of the vehicle forensic type companies. So the folks up at Quantico tried to work on it, did not produce. So there's not a great story to that. That's Pam Hupp. And then that's why I'm being a little careful what I've said. The original homicide was in a semi-rural county just north of where I was based called Lincoln County. And the current Lincoln County prosecutor just last year the case was reopened, and he has issued murder charges against Pam Hupp for the original murder of Betsy Faria. That's an ongoing active case. It hasn't gone to trial. I haven't been contacted. I don't know if I will. But the story is that she has been charged with that murder. I'm telling you that would not have happened if we would have, unfortunately, Mr. Gumpenberger had not been killed and we had not analyzed that cell phone to start. That cell phone was the linchpin that broke the case. I'll never forget, too, in the war room, we put all this evidence together and the head prosecuting attorney, he's a great guy, still in office, doing an amazing job. He comes into the office. This is another part of my career I'll never forget. And everybody's sitting there and the commanders walk him through and he asks his questions and everybody goes through it on the initial. And this is when we're reviewing the case, and Hupp had not been declared a suspect in the Gumpenberger case and had not been arrested. And he listened to it all. And then he stopped and he looked up and he said, "Hey, Larry, how confident are you? Basically, would you do this? How confident are you in your evidence?" And I said, "I'm confident. Let's go." And he based his charging decision right then. Which was pretty, you know, it's pretty impactful that you can have that kind of impact in the community. But I've been doing this for years. I had a great standing in the community as a forensic examiner. I worked very, very hard at my job. And all that training paid off right there at that case. Now, of course, people are doing this a lot these days, but it was kind of newer, I would say, at that time. So she has been charged. In addition, you'll have to watch the shows or whatever to get this part. She is also considered by many people to be a suspect, not officially charged, in the death of her mother. Her mother died under suspicious circumstances, basically fell from a balcony at a nursing home. That's a whole nother case, but she's considered a suspect in that. So they think she's good for three murders. I'm not saying that she is, but then this thing kind of grew legs because it was world famous in St. Louis. It had a lot of community attention. People knew it. Dateline NBC on the original case had already made, I don't know, 5 or 6 episodes. The only case I've ever done more episodes about was O.J. Simpson and JonBenet Ramsey. And so not only had they already done all these episodes based on the original case, now the suspect was pretending to be a Dateline NBC producer, so you can imagine that's kind of a hook for Dateline. So based on that, I was asked by the prosecutor in my former agency to participate in the Dateline NBC. So the season premiere, I think it was last year, they did a 2-hour special. I was involved in that, and that was a really interesting experience because that Keith Morrison guy, if you know, the lead, really is a good interviewer. There was no prep. There was nothing. I met him. They hooked me up to a mic and we had a conversation, kind of like we're doing here. So it worked out really, really well. You're like Keith Morrison, Kim, just so you know. For the first time ever, they also did I think it was a 6-part series, a podcast called The Thing About Pam, based on this case. And I'm in the last 2 episodes and I talk about the digital evidence, same as I'm doing here. And it was like number 1 on the Apple, you know, iTunes downloads for like weeks and weeks. It was like, wow, this thing, people are really interested in this thing. You know, I'm thinking this is some little St. Louis case. And then, because you never know what takes or what has legs. But as we speak, for some reason down in Louisiana, they are filming a 6-part episode movie on the case. And Renee Zellweger, if you know who that is, the Jerry Maguire. She was the girlfriend of Jerry Maguire, which is a great movie, a great rom-com. Watch it if you haven't. So she is playing Pam Hupp. And they haven't called me. I know nothing about it. I don't even know if they'll feature the digital evidence. But the truth is the digital evidence allowed us to figure out how these two stars collided. I've always heard before in homicide classes, I don't know why this always stuck in my head, but the best crime to get away with, or if you really want to get away with a crime, kill somebody completely unknown or unrelated to you in any way, right? And that's what happened in this case. They had never crossed paths anywhere on this planet at any time until that happened. So that really was the linchpin that, and again, a bunch of evidence really locked into place. So in the beginning, when we first charged it, it was like, you better hope you know what you're doing, because your trial is going to be on your shoulders with digital evidence. And then bam, 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 all this other stuff started falling into place with that. So that was really an incredible experience. You know, digital evidence, there's very few crimes that don't involve digital evidence. This one had a lot of digital evidence, mainly the phone in the cloud for this case. And it doesn't always work, right? Because there are a lot of variables. But man, when it does, it does. And this case was the perfect example because it was a third-party independent witness. Louis Gumpenberger knew what happened that day. He wasn't saying. Pam Hupp knew what happened that day, and she was telling her version. But there was a third witness, that phone, and the digital data on that phone. And that witness told the truth. The one thing I did want to mention that I forgot about, one of the things we did, in addition, I said, I got the pin of her on the map, but I took all those locations from that day initially, and then I had to expand out. This was, you know, months of work, right? I took that initial information, and I made a timeline, and I took every geolocation point. Google says at this date and this time, she's at this Latin long. And I made a list. And then I looked up that Latin long and I said, well, that's roughly the intersection of these two streets. And I would put a location to it. And I sent that to the detectives, the team. And the boss gave team, split everybody up and said, wherever Google says, here's your set, here's your set, here's your set, go see if there's cameras. And anywhere they went, if there was a camera, she drove past the Quick Trip, the market. She was driving around other mobile home parks, and some people had cameras, and we beat on every door. If Google said she was there, guess what? And there was a camera, guess what? She was there. And we had images of that, so we could recreate that, which you could really see if you look at it, was a pattern leading up to the date of the crime and the morning of the crime that she was driving around trying to do this recruitment. We had that one woman, I think it was Carol Alfred, that came forward and said, hey, she tried to do it to me, and I got her on video trying to do it. But she had been doing that for several days prior. We did have one other person that came forward and said, yeah, I was one of these people she tried to recruit. But so obviously what we believe happened is that she's driving around trolling for a victim, somebody to, you know, she could pretend to be a Dateline NBC producer, someone that she could offer $1,000 to reenact a 911 call, and she was going to take him to the set. She comes across Mr. Gumpenberger. She spends very few minutes, gets him in the car, and is on the way. I have to believe that on the way to the crime, which was her house, that she probably figured out that he wasn't mentally capable of doing this, and she was probably frustrated because during the 911 call, there's a point, and if you listen to the podcast or the TV show, it's on there, where you can hear her say, no, no, no. And, you know, some people hear that as like, no, 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 like, oh, you're coming at me with the knife. But if you listen to it in inflection of her tone, I think she's like, you're screwing up the script, buddy. No, no, don't do it that way. But again, that's conjecture because we'll never know.
So we have this first crime that occurred with her best friend.
Betsy Free.
So Betsy was killed and...
Correct. Stabbed 55 times.
Wow.
Yes, ma'am.
And it was thought that her husband had done that, but it was overturned.
Yeah, so she was stabbed 55 times with a serrated kitchen knife that was left lodged in her neck. And when Russell Faria, the husband, comes home, he immediately calls 911. He is completely distraught. Now people will argue over 911 calls, but he says, I think my wife committed suicide. And then a lot of people say, well, come on, buddy, she stabbed 55 times. But then people argue, well, the way, you know, she was laying, he couldn't have known she had was, oh, I didn't mention this. She was terminally ill with cancer. She was dying. Wow. Anyway. And they all knew it. She had just, in fact, that morning, the reason Pam Hupp was the last one to see her, she was at chemotherapy and her other friend was going to pick her up and bring her home. But Pam suddenly called out of nowhere and insisted on being the one to pick her up and bring her home. So Pam picked her up from chemotherapy and brought her home. So, sorry I interrupted you there, but yes. So Russell's the one who calls 911. They convict him of the homicide, and he does some time in prison.
All right. So, but then it's overturned.
Yes, ma'am.
All right. So then we have separate, unrelated seeming crime that has occurred where she's trying to make it out that it is a home invasion, right? And she has a note that has been written with him. She has all of this planned out. She has the money that she's given him that's there with him then, as you said. She had driven by his house that day. She'd been shopping, actually, for someone, right?
Yeah, I believe so.
So it just so happened that it was he who she got.
Yep.
And she's, what is the connection between here? Why did she pick him? Why was she even trying to have this occur?
You know, that's a great question. And that's one that we'll never know. We ponder over. But here's what we believe. Sociopath is a word that can be thrown out really easily. But boy, I think this is one. And those two stars happen to line. She happened to be driving down the road. And we know that because of the cloud data and the Samsung, right? And the geolocation information from Google, that she was driving down the road and found him. But we know that prior to this, and even that morning, it appears she was driving around just trying to find someone that she could lure to offer that $1,000. She also plants this note on him. And what she's trying to do is, at this time, the acquittal has happened. Russ is free. And it's being re-looked at by several entities, including the U.S. Attorney's Office in the Eastern District of Missouri is taking a second look. So I don't know if she was trying to deflect attention away from herself to make it look like, no, it really was Russ the whole time, and that's what we believe she was doing, because it was rearing its head again, and they were starting to take a second look at her, like, is she really the suspect? Or did she just need that attention? You know, did she just, I don't think she hates the attention, to be honest with you. That's my opinion. So I don't know if I answered that, Kim, but I think she was trying to, the heat was back on, and she was trying to make Russ look like that he really was the one all along.
So she's trying to connect some dots for the police, she most likely, or that's a guess, right?
Yep, she's trying to manipulate the situation. Think about it. If you, what the case purports is that she manipulated Betsy Free into signing over $150,000 life insurance, manipulated her and her friend to be the one to pick her up, you know, is the one to kill her. And there's a lot more to the story that we haven't even touched on. You know, cell phone evidence that keeps her in the area a half hour later. Russ Faria was at game night with four friends who testified in the original trial. He was with us. And the closing arguments of the original prosecutor is like, oh, it's a big conspiracy. These four people are lying for him. I mean, it's crazy, but you remember, if you're all sitting here going, well, wait a minute, well, how does that, the original trial for the murder of Betsy was overturned for several things, but one of the things was the judge denied the defense the ability to even introduce Pam Hupp as a possible suspect or to introduce that the life insurance had been signed over. So Pam Hupp was never in the original trial for murder. Nothing about her. It was just, husband comes home, she stabbed 55 times, you know, blah, blah, blah. So, yeah, I think she was just trying to make it look like you guys got it wrong and it was Russ all along and take the heat off herself. And I think she enjoyed the game. I'll never know that. I can't state that with any evidence. I just think she is a master manipulator. She loves to be in control. She loves to have her say, and she was just almost entertainment in a weird way. This is what she does.
So was Pam married? Did Pam have kids?
She was married. She had older kids who were out of the house, or she lived at home with her husband. Yes, she was married.
I'm just wondering where they are when all of these things are going on with her, when she's trying to orchestrate these things.
Older kids off, out of their life. Husband, there's been a lot of conjecture about him, that she was kind of a strong, dominant personality, and that he might have been a little bit of a weaker personality. I don't know. I really wasn't involved in that, but I think the common theme is that he really didn't know what was going on. He was just like, yes, dear, kind of thing. And that he was just kind of this dupe almost himself. I don't know if that's accurate or if it's true somewhere in the middle, but I wasn't involved in that part of the investigation. And I did not. I would have loved to have gotten any digital devices that he had. There was no nexus to it. There was, interestingly enough, I didn't go to the crime scene, but I reviewed the photos. that there was a clean spot on the carpet in one room with dirt all around it. You can picture it where you can see a tower computer used to sit. But at the day of the crime, there was no tower computer sitting there. So I never did get a computer from that scene. So I would love to. I'd love to have seen the husband's digital devices. Obviously, there was no nexus to that. I'd like to have seen all our family's digital devices. There was no. Interestingly enough, we reached out to just to exclude Russ because this Russ Faria guy was, the one who was acquitted in all these Dateline shows, and she's trying to say that this guy was trying to kidnap her. We did contact Russ's attorney, who, got the acquittal. His name's Joel Schwartz, and we said, hey, we'd like to look at his cell phone. And he's like, we're on our way. We're coming now. When do you want us? And they raced up to the station. So I did sit down in the interview room with the attorney and Russ. He immediately signed over consent, and I did dump his cell phone and go through it. And obviously there was no connection to the events of that day. The question that I would ask, and I bet the audience would ask, is did Pam have a cell phone when Betsy was killed? And the answer to that is yes, but they didn't send it to the lab. So we have this very robust lab, and we did some digital evidence on that original case. But for some reason, they had just gotten a cell phone analysis tool. And they, if you're in law enforcement, you know how it is. There's some people that are like, hey, I'm going to be the cell phone guy, and, maybe I can make a career after law enforcement with this. I don't know that's what happened, but I think that's what happened. But they didn't send her phone from the original killing down to us. They did it themselves. And they did just a logical extraction, and it did not produce anything. I would argue that I would have loved to have seen that phone and done a little more with it. Anyway, I'll leave it at that.
So tell me, her mother also died of suspicious situation. Is that what you said? Her mother
So her mom's name is Shirley Newman, and her mom had been living alone. It was a third floor apartment in a senior living community center over in St. Louis County. And I don't remember the year, but it was before the Betsy Faria killing, but Pam Hubb, the mom had like dementia and arthritis, and was elderly, and allegedly Pam had come to visit with her and spent some time with her and then dropped her off at her apartment. And she told the staff, hey, don't expect my mom for dinner this evening or breakfast tomorrow morning either. I don't know more about that. I just remember that piece that she tells the staff, don't expect her for dinner or breakfast next morning. So the next day, the housekeeper is doing her thing and founds Newman dead beneath that third floor balcony. She's out on the ground, dead underneath this balcony. And that wasn't like till 2:30 the next day she was found, in the afternoon sometime. But what it looked like is the aluminum balcony railing was broke. It was an aluminum balcony, if I remember right. I know this is in one of the shows, but it was like the balusters, the vertical slats were broken through like she went through it. And at that time, the police investigation, the medical examiner just, she died from blunt trauma because from the fall, obviously. But during the autopsy, there was like a high amount of a sedative in her blood, like 8 times the normal concentration of a normal dose. So she had all this sedative. But the St. Louis County, I think, investigation was inconclusive or accidental even. But then after Faria and then after Gumpenberger, I think St. Louis County reopened that investigation and made that death finding to be, I don't remember the actual term for it, not inconclusive, but it's open, the manner of death. So it's an open case as well. But what happened was after the mom died, the month afterwards, Lincoln County, which is the original agency who did the investigation into Betsy Faria's death, had an anonymous note sent that suggested that Pam Hupp, who was the last person to see her mom alive, had murdered her mom for her mom's life insurance, which she was the recipient of. Pam and her siblings each got $120,000 from the mom's death. Earlier that year, prior to our mom's death, I'm trying to get to this because I wasn't involved in that investigation. So I'm trying to remember if mom died before or after, but there was this issue where Pam had said on videotape, and I think it was during the Faria. It was during Betsy's death investigation. She's being interviewed by a detective who's talking about insurance money, and Hupp makes this flip statement about, hey, my mom's worth $500,000 when she dies. If I really wanted money, there's an easier way than trying to fight somebody who's stronger than me. So she makes this weird comment like, if I really wanted money, insurance money, I'd go kill my mom. It was an accidental death. I'm not sure where that is. So sorry, I can't give you more about that. But the mom has died under suspicious circumstances.
So out of curiosity, what was Pam doing with this money? She's come into, a good amount of money here from both of these different deaths.
Yeah, I didn't look at that part of the investigation. I wasn't involved at that. And I remember they did look at that very well. I don't think that, to my knowledge or my memory, that wasn't like she did anything extravagant. I can't say, oh, she had a gambling habit or, she went on the trip of a lifetime. I don't have any of that. Don't know.
So tell me, where is Pam right now?
Pam's in prison for, I think it's life plus 30. She got life. It was interesting. I was ready for that trial. I'm a weird duck. I don't mind trial. Put me on the stand. Bring it. Let's go. I'm excited. Let's do it. And I was prepping. And she took what's called an Alfred plea. You know what that is? So essentially, she didn't plead guilty, but it's a court mechanism that says, okay, you have enough to convict me of guilty, and I'm going to take a guilty plea, but I'm not going to allocute and say exactly what I did. I think the community was a little disappointed because they wanted to hear her take ownership and say exactly what she did, but it was the best we were going to get without going to full trial. We had charged her with the death penalty. First time a female had been charged with the death penalty in the state of Missouri since like the 50s, so that gathered attention too. But the prosecutor, who was a friend of mine, now, from years of working together, he made a good argument that, look, a trial was going to cost, I think they figured out $350,000 initially, automatic appeals. They were going to drain this county because it was the 11th Circuit here. They were going to drain those bank accounts for years and years and years to get to the same place we'd get with the Alfred plea or the death penalty. So they took death off the table, said if she'll take life, we'll let her take the Alfred plea. And she is sitting in the Chillicothe Correctional Center, last I heard, just sitting up there. Now, I know that, she said in a jail call, I believe I'd heard, that she basically just claimed that she pled guilty so her family wouldn't have to witness an ugly trial. But so to my knowledge, she's never fully taken ownership. She's just sitting up there. And again, there is an active pending case. She has been charged now by the Lincoln County prosecutor with that original murder of Betsy Faria. So that's going forward. No idea if I'll get called on that. But, I'm giving you some other background information that any other citizen would know. The stuff on Gumpenberger is the stuff that I know and lived. But
absolutely. Thank you very much. This has been a great glimpse into these cases that have kind of evolved around Pam. So we appreciate your insight.
Well, I was going to say, I have to tell you, it was a good case and everybody did a phenomenal job and everybody worked hard. It was a huge team effort. But, if I sit back, I've got better cases than this one. But this is the one, you never know, that grabs the community's attention. It really grabbed people's attention so much so they're making a movie out of it, which is crazy. And no one's called me. I've talked to no one, but I'm hoping that they feature the digital evidence because it was an important component. And if they are going to feature the digital evidence, I hope that Daniel Craig is the one who plays me. Yeah, probably not.
You can always ask, right?
Yeah, nobody's called. So no, I'm kidding. You never know what Hollywood's going to do, but, the other thing, really an interesting story too, is I think they're going to focus more, my guess, on the defense attorney Joel, who really did a phenomenal job. It's one of those things where, you know, you see those TV shows once in a while, and we deal with court cases all the time where this guy just wouldn't let it go. He knew there was a travesty of justice. He knew something wasn't right, and he was just going to make it right in the universe. And so that's probably the story they're going to tell, and that's a great story to tell too. So digital evidence and a defense attorney who really stood up and said, I'm going to make this right.
And he was the defense attorney for?
Russell Faria.
Well, fantastic, Larry. Thank you so much. This has been a great time chatting through this with you. I really appreciate your time, and your insights are phenomenal with this case. And be curious to see what happens with this in the future.
Yep. Yeah, I'm on pins and needles too, just like anybody else. But it hasn't come to court yet. But you know, I do have an alert set on that name. So if stuff pops in the press, you know, I get my little Google alerts, and that's how I find out, just like any other person.
So, Larry, do you mind to just share with me a bit about what do you feel like that digital evidence means to these types of cases?
Well, they're not that there can't be, but almost every case involves digital evidence. Now, let me say this. I was a regular detective before a digital one, before a forensic examiner. So we can never forget about traditional evidence, you know, fingerprints, interviews, neighborhood canvases, the who, what, where, when, and why. But we always have to look for that digital footprint, that digital overlay, because there are almost no crimes or cases these days that don't have a digital nexus. So whether it's, in this case, the cell phone in the cloud, and the car's infotainment center, which didn't play out, but and there was no computer, as we talked about, but that cell phone and that cloud information, it is that third-party independent witness. Look, if you've never heard this, some people are going to roll their eyes, but I love talking about Locard's principle, Locard Lockard's principle of exchange, right? Here we go with the professor hat. Lockard's principle of exchange is a famous theory that really is used a lot or relates to traditional evidence, traditional criminology, you know, fingerprints, gunshot residue, bloodborne pathogens, whatever, where two things are come in contact, something's going to be transferred and left behind, you know, fibers, things like that. But that applies to hitting a key on a keyboard. That applies to hitting an app on a cell phone. There is a piece of exchange, something almost always is left behind. So when that team came in and that Mr. Gumpenberger is laying there dead, murdered, we now know, this mentally handicapped man murdered in this evil way. But we show up, we think we have a home invasion, we look at that crime scene. I show up on the periphery at this time. Sometimes I go in, depending on the case, but certainly still have to step over the dead bodies, unfortunately. But I go and I stop, and while they're focused on the fibers and the bloodborne pathogen and the gunshot residue or whatever, what's the digital footprint of that crime scene? Where's the modem? Where's the computer? Where's the cell phone? What cloud type evidence is out there that is potential to us? I want to see that digital footprint. And that is my job. My job for the team is to work that digital footprint, you know, to preserve. Now, it's a little bit weird. You might be sitting there. A lot of times, I think what we've morphed into is that we have, and nobody yell at me, I remember I was a regular detective who became this cyber detective. So I kind of went the extra mile that I would do things that a lot of examiners might say, no, I just extract the devices. I don't do all that extra stuff. Sometimes something's lost when we don't. Nobody had this expertise. We're almost at the level where a good-sized department should have an examiner or two, and they probably should have a couple detectives that are trained in cyber investigations that understand what that is. But that was an important component. My investigators at that homicide, they didn't know what to ask. They knew, okay, dump a phone. They didn't know Google location services. They don't know preservation letters. They don't know any of that. They wouldn't even have done that. How many crime scenes have we had where people haven't leveraged this evidence when they had legal authority to do so? How many murder seconds, you know, crimes of passion are really premeditated? I had one like that. That's another story for another day, but I'll tell you how digital evidence proved a capital case that everybody thought was a crime of passion. But that's where things are heading. The issues that we have, though, are big data. Even on homicides, sometimes we are not completing forensic exams. We're just walking away. We get what we get and we move away. You can always pull it back off a shelf and relook at it. But sometimes we're overwhelmed with and I teach this in all my classes. If you come to any magnet forensics training, you're going to hear me say it's all about TTE. Time to evidence. Get it quickly so it moves that investigation along. Sometimes we get in the habit where the forensics is so far behind that it's like, you know, the investigation's waiting on the forensics. The forensics should be right at the beginning and concurrent with that investigation so it drives the investigation. Again, I'll tell you that other story another day about how we made a murder first and that if we wouldn't have that evidence, that interview wouldn't know the right questions to ask. That digital evidence can drive the right intelligent questions to really get a handle on what goes on because it is that third party independent witness. The other issue that we're having because of the volume that we're getting a lot of people that are doing forensics now that don't have investigative backgrounds. That's okay. But I still think you should have an investigative background mindset in that room reviewing those. Because a lot of times, and I'm getting this directly, I just had lunch recently with a dear friend who is now an assistant U.S. attorney. You know, I'm at that age where all my friends are now judges or, you know, those kind of spots. It means I'm getting older. But, and she was complaining to me over lunch that the breakdown that we currently have in digital forensics is that, you know, we have examiners who are producing data and handed to investigators who don't know how to interpret it. They don't know how to testify to it. They don't even know what it means. So we have shell bags or SRAM or, you know, whatever. That's the ones I'm pulling out of my hat that are in the report that mean something, that are absolutely evidentiary. But there's a breakdown in communication that they're just dumping data and not giving it a proper interpretation, or the investigator doesn't even know what questions to ask. Then they get on the stand and they can't tie it together. So, and I get why that happens, because we're overwhelmed. It's get it and go. We got a lot of cases. We got a lot of data. But we're starting to see cracks in the seams. That's my firm belief. And actually trying to put a white paper together on that. But we're having cracks at the seams, and the cracks at the seams are we're dumping data and dumping that data on somebody's desk who doesn't really have the context to make all the links. Now, not everybody's doing that. A lot of good examiners out there in their report will draw those links together, but some don't always do that. Something to think about. I don't want to sound critical, but it's something we really have to think about.
So let me ask you this. What's the answer? How do we solve that?
You know, that's a great question. I'm so glad you asked. I got goosebumps. I get so geeky. I love talking about this stuff. It's not human beings. Now, it is, but it's not. Look, we'll never, ever, I don't think, maybe I'm being limited in my vision, we'll never people our way out of this problem. We can't hire enough, train enough, retain enough. That is not the way it's going to happen. Now, so what we need to do is save those examiners to put their eyes on what they really need to put their eyes on, because there is an art to the science of digital forensics. So you need that mindset. You know, I've been on homicide scenes. I've been in meth labs. I've stood there after the guy just committed suicide when I was the first through the door. I had all that context, so I could make all those investigative connections. Really, it's time to TTE, time to evidence. You'll hear me say this in my course, because what is the biggest challenge we have? You'll hear me say these in any magnet courses as well. It's volume. Volume in the number of cases we have to deal with, volume in the number of devices in each case. You know, it's not just you go to the house and get the laptop and cell phone, right? And it's the volume in the amount of storage in each device, the terabytes and terabytes in simple residential homes. So we have to learn to be more efficient with our tools, our time, and our techniques, all that TTE, TTTs. And the way I think the future is, and I think Magnet, you know, is really kind of on to this, products like automating that evidence, ingestion, preparing it, Magnet review, where you have analysts look at it, and then knowing where to quickly and efficiently hone down on their artifacts. I always tell people Axiom, if you're an Axiom user, to me, is all about one thing, filtering and sorting. filtering and sorting large data sets to the data sets you need to actually get your eyes on to make context to drive that investigation, whether it's to show somebody did it or didn't do it, inculpatory or exculpatory. So I think the wave of the future is automating the ingestion and production of digital evidence, review platforms where analysts are looking at that. But I do think then there is a need for an examiner, maybe an elevated position, if you want to call it that, just somebody with some additional training, an examiner who also is an investigator in the law enforcement arena to then review it, to interpret between the lab and that gumshoe detective who's out there hustling the streets trying to put it together. There has to be an interpreter between the two. And I really saw that as my job as a computer forensic examiner. But I don't know that everyone's doing it that way. But that's my belief. How many people do you think I made mad with my opinion? No, I'm kidding.
I think that I think you made a lot of people very happy, actually.
Oh, okay. It is. We have a breakdown. Now we understand digital evidence. We're producing a lot of it. But there's a breakdown when it comes to the court system, and there is a breakdown on the road. I'll tell you the other biggest breakdown, to be honest with you, and it's almost criminal to me, is defense. Prosecution gets it. Law enforcement gets it. Defense is barely touching it. They're really not doing anything with it. And I almost think that, you know, any case where a computer examiner is working for law enforcement, that defense side should have an independent third-party examiner that looks at it from their viewpoint. And I've had them do that before, and it almost just is a confirmation that their client was done well or justice was served. That's another opinion. I know that might be a little weird coming from a retired detective, but it only helps the system be stronger. But I get it takes money and time, right?
It absolutely does take money and time to do those things. But it is part of the entire system. It's part of the whole system that, you know, each side
has a right
to see the evidence. Yeah, each side has a right to see and understand the evidence that is going to be presented or be used within that case. So I do understand what you're saying there for sure. So, wow. Thanks, Larry. This has been a phenomenal, phenomenal episode. We really appreciate your time today. And also, we're going to leave on this note, Larry, that you have to promise to come back again for another episode or another 10 episodes. I don't know.
It was fun. I would love to. You know, I'll also say, I'll let you have last word, Kim. I don't mean to take the last word. But if you're out there right now, whether you're just a citizen who's interested in, you know, law enforcement, true crime, digital evidence, you know, we're glad you're listening in. I'm glad you're listening in. But if you're an examiner who's on the front lines working these kind of cases that I'm talking about, you're always in my thoughts and prayers. You're doing God's work, and I appreciate you and think about you every day.
That's it for this episode. Thanks so much to Larry McLean for telling us about this case. Digital Forensics in Real Life is a production of Magnet Forensics. This episode was mixed and edited by Phil Froklage, with production help from Lindsay Ward. Our original theme music is by Rick Andrade. I'm your host, Kim Bradley. Thanks for listening.